Chapter 15. Nothing happened until afternoon. The doctor was a thin, quiet little man who seemed disturbed by the war. He took out a number of small steel splinters from my thighs with delicate and refined distaste. He used a local anesthetic called something or other snow, which froze the tissue and avoided pain until the probe, the scalpel, or the forceps got below the frozen portion. The anesthetized area was clearly defined by the patient, and after a time the doctor's fragile delicacy was exhausted, and he said it would be better to have an X-ray. Probing was unsatisfactory, he said.
This book is continued on Disc 3. Disc 3.
The anesthetized area was clearly defined by the patient, and after a time the doctor's fragile delicacy was exhausted, and he said it would be better to have an X-ray. Probing was unsatisfactory, he said. The X-ray was taken at the Ospedale Maggiore, and the doctor who did it was excitable, efficient, and cheerful. It was arranged by holding up the shoulders that the patient should see personally some of the larger foreign bodies through the machine. The plates were to be sent over. The doctor requested me to write in his pocket notebook my name and regiment and some sentiment. He declared that the foreign bodies were ugly, nasty, brutal. The Austrians were such bitches. How many had I killed? I had not killed any, but I was anxious to please, and I said I had killed plenty. Miss Gage was with me, and the doctor put his arm around her and said she was more beautiful than Cleopatra. Did she understand that? Cleopatra, the former queen of Egypt. Yes, by God, she was. We returned to the little hospital in the ambulance, and after a while and much lifting, I was upstairs and in bed again. The plates came that afternoon. The doctor had said, by God, he would have them that afternoon, and he did. Catherine Barclay showed them to me. They were in red envelopes, and she took them out of the envelopes and held them up to the light, and we both looked. That's your right leg, she said, then put the plate back in the envelope. This is your left. Put them away, I said, and come over to the bed. I can't, she said. I just brought them in for a second to show you. She went out, and I lay there. It was a hot afternoon, and I was sick of lying in bed. I sent the porter for the papers, all the papers he could get. Before he came back, three doctors came into the room. I noticed that doctors who fail in the practice of medicine have a tendency to seek one another's company and aid in consultation. A doctor who cannot take out your appendix properly will recommend you to a doctor who will be unable to remove your tonsils with success. These were three such doctors. This is the young man, said the house doctor with the delicate hands. How do you do? Said the tall, gaunt doctor with the beard. The third doctor, who carried the X-ray plates in their red envelopes, said nothing. Remove the dressings? Questioned the bearded doctor. Certainly. Remove the dressings, please, nurse, the house doctor said to Miss Gage. Miss Gage removed the dressings. I looked down at the legs. At the field hospital, they had the look of not too freshly ground hamburger steak. Now they were crusted, and the knee was swollen and discolored, and the calf sunken, but there was no pus. Very clean, said the house doctor. Very clean and nice. Mmm, said the doctor with the beard. The third doctor looked over the house doctor's shoulder. Please move the knee, said the bearded doctor. I can't. Test the articulation? The bearded doctor questioned. He had a stripe beside the three stars on his sleeve. That meant he was a first captain. Certainly, the house doctor said. Two of them took hold of my right leg very gingerly and bent it. That hurts, I said. Yes, yes, a little further, doctor. That's enough. That's as far as it goes, I said. Partial articulation, said the first captain. He straightened up. May I see the plates again, please, doctor? The third doctor handed him one of the plates. No, the left leg, please. That is the left leg, doctor. You are right. I was looking from a different angle. He returned the plate. The other plate he examined for some time. You see, doctor, he pointed to one of the foreign bodies which showed spherical and clear against the light. They examined the plate for some time. "Only one thing I can say," the first captain with the beard said. "It is a question of time. 3 months, 6 months, probably." "Certainly the synovial fluid must reform."
"Certainly. It's a question of time. I could not conscientiously open a knee like that before the projectile was insisted."
"I agree with you, doctor."
6 months for what?" I asked.
6 months for the projectile to insist before the knee can be opened safely."
"I don't believe it," I said.
"Do you want to keep your knee, young man?"
"No," I said.
"What?"
"I want it cut off," I said, "so I can wear a hook on it."
"What do you mean, a hook?"
"He is joking," said the house doctor.
He patted my shoulder very delicately.
"He wants to keep his knee. This is a very brave young man. He has been proposed for the Silver Medal of Valor."
"All my felicitations," said the first captain. He shook my hand.
"I can only say that to be on the safe side, you should wait at least 6 months before opening such a knee. You are welcome, of course, to another opinion."
"Thank you very much," I said. "I value your opinion."
The first captain looked at his watch.
"We must go," he said. "All my best wishes."
"All my best wishes and many thanks," I said. I shook hands with the third doctor.
"Capitano Varini, Tenente Henry."
And they all three went out of the room.
"Miss Gage," I called.
She came in.
"Please ask the house doctor to come back a minute."
He came in holding his cap and stood by the bed.
"Did you wish to see me?"
"Yes. I can't wait 6 months to be operated on. My God, doctor, did you ever stay in bed 6 months?"
"You won't be in bed all the time. You must first have the wounds exposed to the sun. Then afterward you can be on crutches."
"For 6 months and then have an operation?"
"That is the safe way. The foreign bodies must be allowed to insist, and the synovial fluid will reform. Then it will be safe to open up the knee."
"Do you really think yourself I will have to wait that long?"
"That is the safe way."
"Who is that first captain?"
"He is a very excellent surgeon of Milan."
"He's a first captain, isn't he?"
"Yes, but he is an excellent surgeon."
"I don't want my leg fooled with by a first captain. If he was any good, he would be a major. I know what a first captain is, doctor."
"He is an excellent surgeon, and I would rather have his judgment than any surgeon I know."
"Could another surgeon see it?"
"Certainly, if you wish, but I would take Dr. Varela's opinion myself."
"Could you ask another surgeon to come and see it?"
"I will ask Valentini to come."
"Who is he?"
"He is a surgeon of the Ospedale Maggiore."
"Good. I appreciate it very much. You understand, doctor, I couldn't stay in bed 6 months."
"You would not be in bed. You would first take a sun cure. Then you could have light exercise. Then, when it was insisted, we would operate."
"But I can't wait 6 months."
The doctor spread his delicate fingers on the cap he held and smiled.
"You are in such a hurry to get back to the front."
"Why not?"
"It is very beautiful," he said. "You are a noble young man."
He stooped over and kissed me very delicately on the forehead.
"I will send for Valentini.
Do not worry and excite yourself. Be a good boy."
"Will you have a drink?" I asked.
"No, thank you. I never drink alcohol."
"Just have one."
I rang for the porter to bring glasses.
"No, no, thank you. They are waiting for me."
"Goodbye," I said.
"Goodbye."
2 hours later, Dr. Valentini came into the room. He was in a great hurry, and the points of his mustache stood straight up. He was a major, his face was tanned, and he laughed all the time.
"How did you do it, this rotten thing?" he asked. "Let me see the plates. Yes, yes, that's it. You look healthy as a goat. Who's the pretty girl? Is she your girl? I thought so. Isn't this a bloody war? How does that feel? You are a fine boy. I'll make you better than you. Does that hurt? You bet it hurts. How they love to hurt you, these doctors. What have they done for you so far? Can't that girl talk Italian? She should learn. What a lovely girl. I could teach her. I will be a patient here myself. No, but I will do all your maternity work free. Does she understand that? Ah, she'll make you a fine boy, a fine blonde like she is. That's fine. That's all right. What a lovely girl. Ask her if she eats supper with me. No, I won't take her away from you. Thank you. Thank you very much, miss. That's all. That's all I want to know."
He patted me on the shoulder.
Leave the dressings off.
Will you have a drink, Dr. Valentini?
A drink? Certainly, I will have 10 drinks. Where are they?
In the armoire. Miss Barclay will get the bottle.
Cheerio! Cheerio to you, miss! What a lovely girl! I will bring you better cognac than that.
He wiped his mustache.
When do you think it can be operated on?
Tomorrow morning. Not before. Your stomach must be empty. You must be washed out.
I will see the old lady downstairs and leave instructions. Goodbye. I see you tomorrow. I'll bring you better cognac than that. You are very comfortable here. Goodbye. Until tomorrow. Get a good sleep. I'll see you early.
He waved from the doorway. His mustaches went straight up. His brown face was smiling. There was a star in a box on his sleeve because he was a major.
Chapter 16.
That night a bat flew into the room through the open door that led onto the balcony and through which we watched the night over the roofs of the town. It was dark in our room, except for the small light of the night over the town, and the bat was not frightened, but hunted in the room as though he had been outside. We lay and watched him, and I do not think he saw us because we lay so still. After he went out, we saw a searchlight come on and watched the beam move across the sky and then go off, and it was dark again. A breeze came in the night, and we heard the men of the anti-aircraft gun on the next roof talking. It was cool, and they were putting on their capes. I worried in the night about someone coming up, but Catherine said they were all asleep. Once in the night we went to sleep, and when I woke she was not there, but I heard her coming along the hall, and the door opened, and she came back to the bed and said it was all right, she had been downstairs, and they were all asleep. She had been outside Miss Van Kampen's door and heard her breathing in her sleep. She brought crackers, and we ate them and drank some vermouth. We were very hungry, but she said that would all have to be gotten out of me in the morning. I went to sleep again in the morning when it was light, and when I was awake I found she was gone again. She came in looking fresh and lovely and sat on the bed, and the sun rose while I had the thermometer in my mouth, and we smelled the dew on the roofs, and then the coffee of the men at the gun on the next roof.
"I wish we could go for a walk," Catherine said. "I'd wheel you if we had a chair."
"How would I get into the chair?"
"We'd do it.
We could go out to the park and have breakfast outdoors." I looked out the open doorway.
"What we'll really do," she said, "is get you ready for your friend Dr. Valentini."
"I thought he was grand."
"I didn't like him as much as you did, but I imagine he's very good."
"Come back to bed, Catherine, please," I said.
"I can't. Didn't we have a lovely night?"
"And can you be on night duty tonight?"
"I probably will, but you won't want me."
"Yes, I will."
"No, you won't. You've never been operated on. You don't know how you'll be."
"I'll be all right."
"You'll be sick, and I won't be anything to you."
"Come back then now."
"No," she said. "I have to do the chart, darling, and fix you up."
"You don't really love me, or you'd come back again."
"You're such a silly boy."
She kissed me.
"That's all right for the chart. Your temperature's always normal. You've such a lovely temperature."
"You've got a lovely everything."
"Oh, no, you have the lovely temperature. I'm awfully proud of your temperature."
"Maybe all our children will have fine temperatures."
"Our children will probably have beastly temperatures."
"What do you have to do to get me ready for Valentini?"
"Not much, but quite unpleasant."
"I wish you didn't have to do it."
"I don't. I don't want anyone else to touch you. I'm silly. I get furious if they touch you."
"Even Ferguson?"
"Especially Ferguson, and Gage, and the other. What's her name?"
"Walker?"
"That's it. They've too many nurses here now. There must be some more patients, or they'll send us away. They have 4 nurses now."
"Perhaps there'll be some. They need that many nurses. It's quite a big hospital."
"I hope some will come. What would I do if they sent me away?"
"They will, unless there are more patients."
"I'd go, too."
"Don't be silly. You can't go yet.
But get well quickly, darling, and we will go somewhere."
"And then what?"
"Maybe the war will be over. It can't always go on."
"I'll get well," I said. "Valentini will fix me."
"He should, with those mustaches.
And, darling, when you're going under the ether, just think about something else, not us, because people get very blabby under an anesthetic."
"What should I think about?"
"Anything, anything but us. Think about your people, or even any other girl."
"No."
"Say your prayers, then. That ought to create a splendid impression."
Maybe I won't talk. That's true. Often people don't talk. I won't talk. Don't brag, darling. Please don't brag. You're so sweet, and you don't have to brag. I won't talk a word. Now you're bragging, darling. You know you don't need to brag. Just start your prayers or poetry or something when they tell you to breathe deeply. You'll be lovely that way, and I'll be so proud of you. I'm very proud of you anyway. You have such a lovely temperature, and you sleep like a little boy with your arm around the pillow and think it's me. Or is it some other girl, some fine Italian girl? It's you. Of course it's me. Oh, I do love you, and Valentini will make you a fine leg. I'm glad I don't have to watch it. And you'll be on night duty tonight. Yes, but you won't care. You wait and see. There, darling, now you're all clean inside and out. Tell me, how many people have you ever loved? Nobody. Not me, even? Yes, you. How many others, really? None. How many have you, how do you say it, stayed with? None. You're lying to me. Yes. It's all right. Keep right on lying to me. That's what I want you to do. Were they pretty? I never stayed with anyone. That's right. Were they very attractive? I don't know anything about it. You're just mine, that's true, and you've never belonged to anyone else. But I don't care if you have. I'm not afraid of them. But don't tell me about them. When a man stays with a girl, when does she say how much it costs? I don't know. Of course not. Does she say she loves him? Tell me that. I want to know that. Yes, if he wants her to. Does he say he loves her? Tell me, please. It's important. He does if he wants to. But you never did, really? No. Not really. Tell me the truth. No, I lied. You wouldn't, she said. I knew you wouldn't. Oh, I love you, darling. Outside, the sun was up over the roofs, and I could see the points of the cathedral with the sunlight on them. I was clean inside and outside and waiting for the doctor. And that's it, Catherine said. She says just what he wants her to? Not always. But I will. I'll say just what you wish, and I'll do what you wish, and then you will never want any other girls, will you? She looked at me very happily. I'll do what you want and say what you want, and then I'll be a great success, won't I? Yes. What would you like me to do now that you're all ready? Come to the bed again. All right, I'll come. Oh, darling, 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 I said. You see, she said, I do anything you want. You're so lovely. I'm afraid I'm not very good at it yet. You're lovely. I want what you want. There isn't any me anymore, just what you want. You sweet. I'm good. Aren't I good? You don't want any other girls, do you? No. You see, I'm good. I do what you want. Chapter 17. When I was awake after the operation, I had not been away. You do not go away. They only choke you. It is not like dying, it is just a chemical choking, so you do not feel. And afterward you might as well have been drunk, except that when you throw up, nothing comes but bile, and you do not feel better afterward. I saw sandbags at the end of the bed. They were on pipes that came out of the cast. After a while, I saw Miss Gage, and she said, "How is it now?" "Better," I said. "He did a wonderful job on your knee." "How long did it take?" 2 hours and a half. "Did I say anything silly?" "Not a thing. Don't talk. Just be quiet." I was sick, and Catherine was right. It did not make any difference who was on night duty. There were 3 other patients in the hospital now, a thin boy in the Red Cross from Georgia with malaria, a nice boy, also thin, from New York with malaria and jaundice, and a fine boy who had tried to unscrew the fuse cap from a combination shrapnel and high-explosive shell for a souvenir. This was a shrapnel shell used by the Austrians in the mountains with a nose cap which went on after the burst and exploded on contact. Catherine Barclay was greatly liked by the nurses because she would do night duty indefinitely. She had quite a little work with the malaria people.
The boy who had unscrewed the nose cap was a friend of ours and never rang at night, unless it was necessary, but between the times of working we were together. I loved her very much, and she loved me. I slept in the daytime, and we wrote notes during the day when we were awake and sent them by Ferguson. Ferguson was a fine girl. I never learned anything about her except that she had a brother in the 52nd Division and a brother in Mesopotamia, and she was very good to Catherine Barclay. "Will you come to our wedding, Fergie?" I said to her once. "You'll never get married." "We will." "No, you won't." "Why not?" "You'll fight before you'll marry."
"We never fight."
"You've time yet."
"We don't fight."
"You'll die then. Fight or die, that's what people do. They don't marry." I reached for her hand.
"Don't take hold of me," she said. "I'm not crying. Maybe you'll be all right, you two. But watch out you don't get her in trouble. You'll get her in trouble and I'll kill you."
"I won't get her in trouble."
"Well, watch out then. I hope you'll be all right. You have a good time."
"We have a fine time." "Don't fight then, and don't get her into trouble."
"I won't."
"Mind you watch out. I don't want her with any of these war babies."
"You're a fine girl, Fergie."
"I'm not. Don't try to flatter me."
"How does your leg feel?"
"Fine."
"How is your head?"
She touched the top of it with her fingers. It was sensitive, like a foot that had gone to sleep. "It's never bothered me."
"A bump like that could make you crazy. It never bothers you?"
"No."
"You're a lucky young man.
Have you the letter done? I'm going down."
"It's here," I said.
"You ought to ask her not to do night duty for a while. She's getting very tired."
"All right, I will."
"I want to do it, but she won't let me.
The others are glad to let her have it. You might give her a little rest."
"All right."
"Miss Van Kampen spoke about you sleeping all the forenoons."
"She would."
"It would be better if you let her stay off nights a little while."
"I want her to."
"You do not. But if you would make her, I'd respect you for it."
"I'll make her."
"I don't believe it."
She took the note and went out. I rang the bell, and in a little while Miss Gage came in.
"What's the matter?"
"I just wanted to talk to you. Don't you think Miss Barclay ought to go off night duty for a while? She looks awfully tired. Why does she stay on so long?"
Miss Gage looked at me. "I'm a friend of yours," she said. "You don't have to talk to me like that."
"What do you mean?"
"Don't be silly. Was that all you wanted?"
"Do you want a vermouth?"
"All right. Then I have to go."
She got out the bottle from the armoire and brought a glass.
"You take the glass," I said. "I'll drink out of the bottle."
"Here's to you," said Miss Gage.
"What did Van Kampen say about me sleeping late in the mornings?"
"She just jawed about it. She calls you our privileged patient."
"To hell with her."
"She isn't mean," Miss Gage said. "She's just old and cranky. She never liked you."
"No."
"Well, I do, and I'm your friend. Don't forget that."
"You're awfully damned nice."
"No, I know who you think is nice, but I'm your friend. How does your leg feel?"
"Fine."
"I'll bring some cold mineral water to pour over it. It must itch under the cast. It's hot outside."
"You're awful nice."
"Does it itch much?"
"No, it's fine."
"I'll fix those sandbags better."
She leaned over.
"I'm your friend."
"I know you are."
"No, you don't, but you will someday."
Catherine Barclay took 3 nights off night duty, and then she came back on again. It was as though we met again after each of us had been away on a long journey.
Chapter 18. We had a lovely time that summer. When I could go out, we rode in a carriage in the park. I remember the carriage, the horse going slowly, and up ahead the back of the driver with his varnished high hat, and Catherine Barclay sitting beside me. If we let our hands touch, just the side of my hand touching hers, we were excited. Afterward, when I could get around on crutches, we went to dinner at Biffy's or the Gran Italia and sat at the tables outside on the floor of the Galleria. The waiters came in and out, and there were people going by and candles with shades on the tablecloths, and after we decided that we liked the Gran Italia best, George, the head waiter, saved us a table.
He was a fine waiter, and we let him order the meal while we looked at the people and the great galleria in the dusk and each other. We drank dry white Capri iced in a bucket. Although we tried many of the other wines, Fraser, Barbara, and the sweet white wines, they had no wine waiter because of the war, and George would smile ashamedly when I asked about wines like Fraser.
"If you imagine a country that makes a wine because it tastes like strawberries," he said.
"Why shouldn't it?" Catherine asked. "It sounds splendid."
"You try it, lady," said George, "if you want to. But let me bring a little bottle of Margaux for the tenente."
"I'll try it too, George."
"Sir, I can't recommend to you. It doesn't even taste like a strawberries."
"It might," said Catherine. "It would be wonderful if it did."
"I'll bring it," said George, "and when the lady is satisfied, I'll take it away."
It was not much of a wine. As he said, it did not even taste like strawberries. We went back to Capri. One evening I was short of money, and George loaned me 100 lire.
"That's all right, tenente," he said. "I know how it is. I know how a man gets short. If you or the lady need money, I've always got money."
After dinner, we walked through the galleria, past the other restaurants and the shops with their steel shutters down, and stopped at the little place where they sold sandwiches. Ham and lettuce sandwiches and anchovy sandwiches made of very tiny brown glazed rolls and only about as long as your finger. They were to eat in the night when we were hungry. Then we got into an open carriage outside the galleria in front of the cathedral and rode to the hospital. At the door of the hospital, the porter came out to help with the crutches. I paid the driver, and then we rode upstairs in the elevator. Catherine got off at the lower floor where the nurses lived, and I went on up and went down the hall on crutches to my room. Sometimes I undressed and got into bed, and sometimes I sat out on the balcony with my leg up on another chair and watched the swallows over the roofs and waited for Catherine. When she came upstairs, it was as though she had been away on a long trip, and I went along the hall with her on the crutches and carried the basins and waited outside the doors, or went in with her. It depended on whether they were friends of ours or not, and when she had done all there was to be done, we sat on the balcony outside my room. Afterward, I went to bed, and when they were all asleep and she was sure they would not call, she came in. I loved to take her hair down, and she sat on the bed and kept very still, except suddenly she would dip down to kiss me while I was doing it, and I would take out the pins and lay them on the sheet, and it would be loose, and I would watch her while she kept very still, and then take out the last two pins, and it would all come down, and she would drop her head, and we would both be inside of it. And it was the feeling of inside a tent or behind a falls. She had wonderfully beautiful hair, and I would lie sometimes and watch her twisting it up in the light that came in the open door, and it shone even in the night as water shines sometimes just before it is really daylight. She had a lovely face and body, and lovely smooth skin, too. We would be lying together, and I would touch her cheeks and her forehead and under her eyes and her chin and throat with the tips of my fingers and say, "Smooth as piano keys." And she would stroke my chin with her fingers and say, "Smooth as emery paper and very hard on piano keys." "Is it rough?" "No, darling, I was just making fun of you." It was lovely in the nights, and if we could only touch each other, we were happy. Besides all the big times, we had many small ways of making love, and we tried putting thoughts in the other one's head while we were in different rooms. It seemed to work sometimes, but that was probably because we were thinking the same thing anyway. We said to each other that we were married the first day she had come to the hospital, and we counted months from our wedding day. I wanted to be really married, but Catherine said that if we were, they would send her away, and if we merely started on the formalities, they would watch her and would break us up. We would have to be married under Italian law, and the formalities were terrific. I wanted us to be married, really, because I was worried about having a child, if I thought about it, but we pretended to ourselves we were married and did not worry much, and I suppose I enjoyed not being married, really. I know one night we talked about it, and Catherine said, "But, darling, they'd send me away." "Maybe they wouldn't." "They would. They'd send me home, and then we would be apart until after the war."
"I'd come on leave."
"You couldn't get to Scotland and back on a leave. Besides, I won't leave you. What good would it do to marry now? We're really married. I couldn't be any more married."
"I only wanted to for you."
There isn't any me. I'm you. Don't make up a separate me.
I thought girls always wanted to be married.
They do, but darling, I am married. I'm married to you. Don't I make you a good wife?
You're a lovely wife.
You see, darling, I had one experience of waiting to be married.
I don't want to hear about it.
You know I don't love anyone but you. You shouldn't mind because someone else loved me.
I do.
You shouldn't be jealous of someone who's dead when you have everything.
No, but I don't want to hear about it.
Poor darling. And I know you've been with all kinds of girls, and it doesn't matter to me.
Couldn't we be married privately some way? Then if anything happened to me, or if you had a child.
There's no way to be married except by church and state. We are married privately. You see, darling, it would mean everything to me if I had any religion, but I haven't any religion.
You gave me the St. Anthony.
That was for luck. Someone gave it to me.
Then nothing worries you?
Only being sent away from you. You're my religion. You're all I've got.
All right, but I'll marry you the day you say.
Don't talk as though you had to make an honest woman of me, darling. I'm a very honest woman. You can't be ashamed of something if you're only happy and proud of it. Aren't you happy?
But you won't ever leave me for someone else.
No, darling, I won't ever leave you for someone else.
I suppose all sorts of dreadful things will happen to us, but you don't have to worry about that.
I don't. But I love you so much, and you did love someone else before.
And what happened to him?
He died.
Yes, and if he hadn't, I wouldn't have met you.
I'm not unfaithful, darling. I've plenty of faults, but I'm very faithful.
You'll be sick of me, I'm so faithful.
I'll have to go back to the front pretty soon.
We won't think about that until you go. You see, I'm happy, darling, and we have a lovely time. I haven't been happy for a long time, and when I met you, perhaps I was nearly crazy. Perhaps I was crazy. But now we're happy, and we love each other. Do let's please just be happy. You are happy, aren't you? Is there anything I do you don't like? Can I do anything to please you? Would you like me to take down my hair? Do you want to play?
Yes, and come to bed.
All right. I'll go and see the patients first.
Chapter 19. The summer went that way. I do not remember much about the days, except that they were hot and that there were many victories in the papers. I was very healthy, and my legs healed quickly, so that it was not very long before I was first on crutches, before I was through with them and walking with a cane. Then I started treatments at the Ospedale Maggiore for bending the knees, mechanical treatments, baking in a box of mirrors with violet rays, massage and baths. I went over there afternoons and afterwards stopped at the café and had a drink and read the papers. I did not roam around the town, but wanted to get home to the hospital from the café. All I wanted was to see Catherine. The rest of the time I was glad to kill. Mostly I slept in the mornings, and in the afternoons sometimes I went to the races and late to the mechanotherapy treatments. Sometimes I stopped in at the Anglo-American Club and sat in a deep leather-cushioned chair in front of the window and read the magazines. They would not let us go out together when I was off crutches, because it was unseemly for a nurse to be seen unchaperoned with a patient who did not look as though he needed attendance. So we were not together much in the afternoons, although sometimes we could go out to dinner if Ferguson went along. Miss Van Kampen had accepted the status that we were great friends because she got a great amount of work out of Catherine. She thought Catherine came from very good people, and that prejudiced her in her favor, finally. Miss Van Kampen admired family very much and came from an excellent family herself. The hospital was quite busy, too, and that kept her occupied. It was a hot summer, and I knew many people in Milan, but always was anxious to get back home to the hospital as soon as the afternoon was over. At the front they were advancing on the Carso. They had taken Cook across from Plava, and were taking the Bainsizza Plateau. The west front did not sound so good. It looked as though the war were going on for a long time. We were in the war now, but I thought it would take a year to get any great amount of troops over and train them for combat. Next year would be a bad year, or a good year, maybe. The Italians were using up an awful amount of men. I did not see how it could go on.
Even if they took all the Bainzitsa and Monte San Gabriele, there were plenty of mountains beyond for the Austrians. I had seen them. All the highest mountains were beyond. On the Carso, they were going forward, but there were marshes and swamps down by the sea. Napoleon would have whipped the Austrians on the plains. He never would have fought them in the mountains. He would have let them come down and whipped them around Verona. Still, nobody was whipping anyone on the Western Front. Perhaps wars weren't won anymore. Perhaps they went on forever. Maybe it was another 100 years' war. I put the paper back on the rack and left the club. I went down the steps carefully and walked up the Via Manzoni. Outside the Grand Hotel, I met old Myers and his wife getting out of a carriage. They were coming back from the races. She was a big-busted woman in black satin. He was short and old, with a white mustache, and walked flat-footed with a cane. "How do you do? How do you do?" She shook hands. "Hello," said Myers. "How were the races?" "Fine. They were just lovely. I had 3 winners." "How did you do?" I asked Myers. "All right. I had a winner." "I never know how he does," Mrs. Myers said. "He never tells me." "I do all right," Myers said. He was being cordial. "You ought to come out." While he talked, you had the impression that he was not looking at you or that he mistook you for someone else. "I will," I said. "I'm coming up to the hospital to see you," Mrs. Myers said. "I have some things for my boys. You're all my boys. You certainly are my dear boys." "They'll be glad to see you." "Those dear boys. You too. You're one of my boys." "I have to get back," I said. "You give my love to all those dear boys. I've got lots of things to bring. I've got some fine marsala and cakes." "Goodbye," I said. "They'll be awfully glad to see you." "Goodbye," said Myers. "You come around to the Galleria. You know where my table is. We're all there every afternoon." I went on up the street. I wanted to buy something at the Cova to take to Catherine. Inside, at the Cova, I bought a box of chocolate, and while the girl wrapped it up, I walked over to the bar. There were a couple of British and some aviators. I had a martini alone, paid for it, picked up the box of chocolate at the outside counter, and walked on home toward the hospital. Outside the little bar up the street from the Scala, there were some people I knew, a vice-consul, 2 fellows who studied singing, and Ettore Moretti, an Italian from San Francisco who was in the Italian army. I had a drink with them. One of the singers was named Ralph Simmons, and he was singing under the name of Enrico Del Credo. I never knew how well he could sing, but he was always on the point of something very big happening. He was fat and looked shopworn around the nose and mouth, as though he had hay fever. He had come back from singing in Piacenza. He had sung Tosca, and it had been wonderful. "Of course you've never heard me sing," he said. "When will you sing here?" "I'll be at the Scala in the fall." "I'll bet they throwed the benches at you," Ettore said. "Did you hear how they threw the benches at him in Modena?" "It's a damned lie." "They threw the benches at him," Ettore said. "I was there. I threw 6 benches myself." "You're just a wop from Frisco." "He can't pronounce Italian," Ettore said. "Everywhere he goes, they throw the benches at him." "Piacenza's the toughest house to sing in the north of Italy," the other tenor said. "Believe me, that's a tough little house to sing." This tenor's name was Edgar Saunders, and he sang under the name of Eduardo Giovanni. "I'd like to be there to see them throw the benches at you," Ettore said. "You can't sing Italian." "He's a nut," said Edgar Saunders. "All he knows how to say is throw benches." "That's all they know how to do when you two sing," Ettore said. "Then when you go to America, you'll tell about your triumphs at the Scala. They wouldn't let you get by the first note at the Scala." "I'll sing at the Scala," Simmons said. "I'm going to sing Tosca in October." "We'll go, won't we, Mac?" Ettore said to the vice-consul. "They'll need somebody to protect them." "Maybe the American army will be there to protect them," the vice-consul said. "Do you want another drink, Simmons? You want a drink, Saunders?" "All right," said Saunders. "I hear you're going to get the silver medal," Ettore said to me. "What kind of citation you going to get?" "I don't know. I don't know I'm going to get it." "You're going to get it. Oh, boy, the girls at the Cova will think you're fine then. They'll all think you killed 200 Austrians or captured a whole trench by yourself.
Believe me, I got to work for my decorations.
How many have you got, Atre? Asked the vice consul.
He's got everything, Simmons said. He's the boy they're running the war for.
I've got the bronze twice and 3 silver medals, said Atre.
But the papers on only one have come through.
What's the matter with the others? Asked Simmons.
The action wasn't successful, said Atre.
When the action isn't successful, they hold up all the medals.
How many times have you been wounded, Atre?
3 times bad. I got a 3 wound stripes, see?
He pulled his sleeve around. The stripes were parallel silver lines on a black background sewed to the cloth of the sleeve about 8 inches below the shoulder.
You got one too, Atre said to me. Believe me, they're fine to have. I'd rather have them than the medals. Believe me, boy, when you got 3, you got something. You only get 1 for a wound that puts you 3 months in the hospital.
Where were you wounded, Atre? Asked the vice consul.
Atre pulled up his sleeve.
Here. He showed the deep, smooth red scar.
Here on my leg. I can't show you that because I got puttees on. And on the foot.
There's dead bone in my foot that stinks right now. Every morning I take new little pieces out and it stinks all the time.
What hit you? Asked Simmons.
A hand grenade. One of those potato mashers. It just blew the whole side of my foot off.
You know those potato mashers?
He turned to me.
Sure.
I saw the son of a bitch throw it, Atre said. It knocked me down and I thought I was dead all right, but those damn potato mashers haven't got anything in them. I shot the son of a bitch with my rifle. I always carry a rifle so they can't tell I'm an officer.
How did he look? Asked Simmons.
That was the only one he had, Atre said. I don't know why he threw it. I guess he always wanted to throw one. He never saw any real fighting, probably. I shot the son of a bitch, all right.
How did he look when you shot him? Simmons asked.
Hell, how should I know? Said Atre. I shot him in the belly. I was afraid I'd miss him if I shot him in the head.
How long have you been an officer, Atre? I asked.
2 years. I'm going to be a captain. How long have you been a lieutenant?
Going on 3 years.
You can't be a captain because you don't know the Italian language well enough, Atre said. You can talk, but you can't read and write well enough. You got to have an education to be a captain. Why don't you go in the American army?
Maybe I will.
I wish to God I could.
Oh, boy, how much does a captain get, Mac?
I don't know exactly. Around $250, I think.
Jesus Christ, what I could do with $250.
You better get in the American army quick, Fred. See if you can't get me in.
All right.
I can command a company in Italian. I could learn it in English easy.
You'd be a general, said Simmons.
No, I don't know enough to be a general. A general's got to know a hell of a lot. You guys think there ain't anything to war. You ain't got brains enough to be a second-class corporal.
Thank God I don't have to be, Simmons said.
Maybe you will if they round up all you slackers. Oh, boy, I'd like to have you two in my platoon. Mac, too. I'd make you my orderly, Mac.
You're a great boy, Atre, Mac said, but I'm afraid you're a militarist.
I'd be a colonel before the war's over, Atre said.
If they don't kill you,
they won't kill me.
He touched the stars at his collar with his thumb and forefinger.
See me do that? We always touch our stars if anybody mentions getting killed.
"Let's go, Sim," said Saunders, standing up.
"All right."
"So long," I said. "I have to go, too." It was 5:45 by the clock inside the bar. "Ciao, Atre."
"Ciao, Fred," said Atre. "That's a pretty fine. You're going to get the silver medal."
"I don't know. I'll get it."
"You'll get it all right, Fred. I heard you were going to get it all right."
"Well, so long," I said. "Keep out of trouble, Atre."
Don't worry about me. I don't drink and I don't run around. I'm an old boozer and whorehound. I know what's good for me.
So long, I said. I'm glad you're going to be promoted captain.
I don't have to wait to be promoted. I'm going to be a captain for merit of war. You know, 3 stars with the crossed swords and crown above.
That's me.
Good luck.
Good luck.
When are you going back to the front?
Pretty soon.
Well, I'll see you around.
So long.
So long. Don't take any bad nickels.
I walked on down a back street that led to a crosscut to the hospital. Atre was 23.
He had been brought up by an uncle in San Francisco and was visiting his father and mother in Torino when war was declared. He had a sister who had been sent to America with him at the same time to live with the uncle, who would graduate from normal school this year. He was a legitimate hero who bored everyone he met. Catherine could not stand him.
"We have heroes, too," she said, "but usually, darling, they're much quieter."
"I don't mind him."
"I wouldn't mind him if he wasn't so conceited and didn't bore me and bore me and bore me."
"He bores me."
"You're sweet to say so, darling, but you don't need to. You can picture him at the front, and you know he's useful, but he's so much the type of boy I don't care for."
"I know."
"You're awfully sweet to know, and I try and like him, but he's a dreadful, dreadful boy, really."
"He said this afternoon he was going to be a captain."
"I'm glad," said Catherine. "That should please him."
"Wouldn't you like me to have some more exalted rank?"
"No, darling. I only want you to have enough rank so that we're admitted to the better restaurants."
"That's just the rank I have."
"You have a splendid rank. I don't want you to have any more rank. It might go to your head. Oh, darling, I'm awfully glad you're not conceited. I'd have married you even if you were conceited, but it's very restful to have a husband who's not conceited."
We were talking softly out on the balcony. The moon was supposed to rise, but there was a mist over the town, and it did not come up, and in a little while it started to drizzle, and we came in. Outside, the mist turned to rain, and in a little while it was raining hard, and we heard it drumming on the roof. I got up and stood at the door to see if it was raining in, but it wasn't, so I left the door open.
"Who else did you see?" Catherine asked.
"Mr. and Mrs. Myers."
"They're a strange lot."
"He's supposed to have been in the penitentiary at home. They let him out to die."
"And he lived happily in Milan forever after."
"I don't know how happily."
"Happily enough after jail, I should think."
"She's bringing some things here."
"She brings splendid things. Were you her dear boy?"
"One of them."
"You are all her dear boys," Catherine said. "She prefers the dear boys." "Listen to it rain."
"It's raining hard."
"And you'll always love me, won't you?"
"Yes."
"And the rain won't make any difference?"
"No."
"That's good, because I'm afraid of the rain."
"Why?" "I was sleepy. Outside, the rain was falling steadily."
"I don't know, darling. I've always been afraid of the rain."
"I like it."
"I like to walk in it, but it's very hard on loving."
"I'll love you always."
"I'll love you in the rain and in the snow and in the hail and... what else is there?"
"I don't know. I guess I'm sleepy."
"Go to sleep, darling, and I'll love you no matter how it is."
"You're not really afraid of the rain, are you?"
"Not when I'm with you."
"Why are you afraid of it?"
"I don't know."
"Tell me."
"Don't make me."
"Tell me."
"No.
Tell me."
"All right. I'm afraid of the rain because sometimes I see me dead in it."
"No."
"And sometimes I see you dead in it."
"That's more likely."
"No, it's not, darling, because I can keep you safe. I know I can, but nobody can help themselves."
"Please stop it. I don't want you to get scotch and crazy tonight. We won't be together much longer."
"No, but I am scotch and crazy, but I'll stop it. It's all nonsense."
"Yes, it's all nonsense."
"It's all nonsense. It's only nonsense. I'm not afraid of the rain. I'm not afraid of the rain. Oh, God, I wish I wasn't."
She was crying. I comforted her, and she stopped crying. But outside, it kept on raining. Chapter 20. One day in the afternoon, we went to the races. Ferguson went too, and Crowell Rogers, the boy who had been wounded in the eyes by the explosion of the shell nose cap. The girls dressed to go after lunch, while Crowell and I sat on the bed in his room and read the past performances of the horses and the predictions in the racing paper. Crowell's head was bandaged, and he did not care much about these races, but read the racing paper constantly and kept track of all the horses for something to do. He said the horses were a terrible lot, but they were all the horses we had. Old Myers liked him and gave him tips. Myers won on nearly every race, but disliked to give tips because it brought down the prices. The racing was very crooked. Men who had been ruled off the turf everywhere else were racing in Italy. Myers' information was good, but I hated to ask him because sometimes he did not answer, and always you could see it hurt him to tell you. But he felt obligated to tell us for some reason, and he hated less to tell Crowell. Crowell's eyes had been hurt. One was hurt badly. And Myers had trouble with his eyes, so he liked Crowell. Myers never told his wife what horses he was playing, and she won or lost, mostly lost, and talked all the time. We four drove out to San Siro in an open carriage. It was a lovely day, and we drove out through the park and out along the tramway and out of town where the road was dusty. There were villas with iron fences and big overgrown gardens and ditches with water flowing and green vegetable gardens with dust on the leaves. We could look across the plain and see farmhouses and the rich green farms with their irrigation ditches and the mountains to the north. There were many carriages going into the racetrack, and the men at the gate let us in without cards because we were in uniform. We left the carriage, bought programs, and walked across the infield and then across the smooth, thick turf of the course to the paddock. The grandstands were old and made of wood, and the betting booths were under the stands and in a row out near the stables. There was a crowd of soldiers along the fence in the infield. The paddock was fairly well filled with people, and they were walking the horses around in a ring under the trees behind the grandstand. We saw people we knew and got chairs for Ferguson and Catherine and watched the horses. They went around, one after the other, their heads down, the grooms leading them. One horse, a purplish black, Crowell swore was dyed that color. We watched him, and it seemed possible. He had only come out just before the bell rang to saddle. We looked him up in the program from the number on the groom's arm, and it was listed a black gelding named Japalak. The race was for horses that had never won a race worth 1,000 lire or more. Catherine was sure his color had been changed. Ferguson said she could not tell. I thought he looked suspicious. We all agreed we ought to back him and pooled 100 lire. The odd sheet showed he would pay 35 to 1. Crowell went over and bought the ticket while we watched the jockeys ride around once more and then go out under the trees to the track and gallop slowly up to the turn where the start was to be. We went up in the grandstand to watch the race. They had no elastic barrier at San Siro then, and the starter lined up all the horses. They looked very small way up the track, and then sent them off with the crack of his long whip. They came past us with the black horse well in front, and on the turn he was running away from the others. I watched him on the far side with the glasses and saw the jockey fighting to hold him in, but he could not hold him, and when they came around the turn and into the stretch, the black horse was 15 lengths ahead of the others. He went way on up and around the turn after the finish. "Isn't it wonderful?" Catherine said. "We'll have over 3,000 lire. He must be a splendid horse." "I hope his color doesn't run," Crowell said, "before they pay off." "He was really a lovely horse," Catherine said. "I wonder if Mr. Myers backed him." "Did you have the winner?" I called to Myers. He nodded. "I didn't," Mrs. Myers said. "Who did you children bet on?" "Japalak." "Really? He's 35 to 1. "We liked his color." "I didn't. I thought he looked seedy. They told me not to back him."
"He won't pay much," Myers said.
"He's marked 35 to 1 in the quotes," I said.
"He won't pay much. At the last minute," Myers said, "they put a lot of money on him."
"Who?"
"Kempton and the boys. You'll see, he won't pay 2 to 1.
"Then we won't get 1,000 lire, Catherine said. "I don't like this crooked racing."
"We'll get 200 lire.
"That's nothing. That doesn't do us any good. I thought we were going to get 3,000.
"It's crooked and disgusting," Ferguson said.
"Of course," said Catherine. "If it hadn't been crooked, we'd never have backed him at all. But I would have liked the 3,000 lire.
"Let's go down and get a drink and see what they pay," Crowell said.
We went out to where they posted the numbers, and the bell rang to pay off, and they put up 1850 after Japalak to win. That meant he paid less than even money on a 10 lire bet. We went to the bar under the grandstand and had a whiskey and soda apiece. We ran into a couple of Italians we knew, and McAdams, the vice consul, and they came up with us when we joined the girls. The Italians were full of manners, and McAdams talked to Catherine while we went down to bed again.
Mr. Myers was standing near the paramutual.
"Ask him what he played," I said to Crowell.
"What are you on, Mr. Myers?" Crowell asked.
Myers took out his program and pointed to the number 5 with his pencil.
"Do you mind if we play him too?" Crowell asked.
Go ahead, but don't tell my wife I gave it to you."
"Will you have a drink?" I asked.
"No, thanks. I never drink."
We put 100 lire on number 5 to win and 100 to place, and then had another whiskey and soda apiece. I was feeling very good, and we picked up a couple more Italians, who each had a drink with us, and went back to the girls. These Italians were also very mannered, and matched manners with the 2 we had collected before. In a little while, no one could sit down. I gave the tickets to Catherine.
"What horse is it?"
"I don't know. Mr. Myers' choice."
"Don't you even know the name?"
"No, you can find it on the program. Number 5, I think."
"You have touching faith," she said.
The number 5 won, but did not pay anything. Mr. Myers was angry.
"You have to put up 200 lire to make 20, he said. 12 lire for 10. It's not worth it. My wife lost 20 lire.
"I'll go down with you," Catherine said to me. The Italians all stood up. We went downstairs and out to the paddock.
"Do you like this?" Catherine asked.
"Yes, I guess I do."
"It's all right, I suppose," she said. "But, darling, I can't stand to see so many people."
"We don't see many."
"No, but those Myers and the man from the bank with his wife and daughters."
"He cashes my sight drafts," I said.
"Yes, but someone else would if he didn't. Those last 4 boys were awful."
"We can stay out here and watch the race from the fence."
"That will be lovely. And, darling, let's back a horse we've never heard of, and that Mr. Myers won't be backing."
"All right." We backed a horse named Light for Me that finished 4th in a field of 5. We leaned on the fence and watched the horses go by, their hoofs thudding as they went past, and saw the mountains off in the distance and Milan beyond the trees and the fields.
"I feel so much cleaner," Catherine said.
The horses were coming back through the gate, wet and sweating, the jockeys quieting them and riding up to dismount under the trees.
"Wouldn't you like a drink? We could have one out here and see the horses."
"I'll get them," I said.
"The boy will bring them," Catherine said.
She put her hand up, and the boy came out from the pagoda bar beside the stables. We sat down at a round iron table.
"Don't you like it better when we're alone?"
"Yes," I said.
"I felt very lonely when they were all there."
"It's grand here," I said.
"Yes, it's really a pretty course."
"It's nice."
"Don't let me spoil your fun, darling. I'll go back whenever you want."
"No," I said. "We'll stay here and have our drink. Then we'll go down and stand at the water jump for the steeplechase."
"You're awfully good to me," she said.
After we had been alone a while, we were glad to see the others again.
We had a good time.
Chapter 21. In September, the first cool nights came, then the days were cool, and the leaves on the trees in the park began to turn color, and we knew the summer was gone. The fighting at the front went very badly, and they could not take San Gabriele. The fighting on the Bainsitsa plateau was over, and by the middle of the month the fighting for San Gabriele was about over too. They could not take it. Ettore was gone back to the front. The horses were gone to Rome, and there was no more racing. Crowell had gone to Rome, too, to be sent back to America. There were riots twice in the town against the war and bad rioting in Turin. A British major at the club told me the Italians had lost 150,000 men on the Bainsitsa Plateau and on San Gabriele. He said they had lost 40,000 on the Carso besides. We had a drink, and he talked. He said the fighting was over for the year down here, and that the Italians had bitten off more than they could chew. He said the offensive in Flanders was going to the bad. If they killed men as they did this fall, the Allies would be cooked in another year. He said we were all cooked, but we were all right as long as we did not know it. We were all cooked. The thing was not to recognize it. The last country to realize they were cooked would win the war. We had another drink. Was I on somebody's staff? No, he was. It was all balls. We were alone in the club, sitting back in one of the big leather sofas. His boots were smoothly polished dull leather. They were beautiful boots. He said it was all balls.
They thought only in divisions and manpower. They all squabbled about divisions and only killed them when they got them. They were all cooked. The Germans won the victories. By God, they were soldiers. The old Hun was a soldier, but they were cooked too. We were all cooked. I asked about Russia. He said they were cooked already. I'd soon see they were cooked. Then the Austrians were cooked too. If they got some Hun divisions, they could do it. Did he think they could attack this fall? Of course they would. The Italians were cooked. Everybody knew they were cooked. The old Hun would come down through the Trentino and cut the railway at Vicenza, and then where would the Italians be? They tried that in 16, I said. Not with Germans. Yes, I said. But they probably wouldn't do that, he said. It was too simple. They'd try something complicated and get royally cooked. I had to go, I said. I had to get back to the hospital. Goodbye, he said. Then cheerily, every sort of luck. There was a great contrast between his world pessimism and personal cheeriness. I stopped at a barber shop and was shaved and went home to the hospital. My leg was as well as it would get for a long time. I had been up for examination 3 days before. There were still some treatments to take before my course at the Ospedale Maggiore was finished, and I walked along the side street, practicing not limping. An old man was cutting silhouettes under an arcade. I stopped to watch him. Two girls were posing, and he cut their silhouettes together, snipping very fast and looking at them, his head on one side. The girls were giggling. He showed me the silhouettes before he pasted them on white paper and handed them to the girls. "They're beautiful," he said. "How about you, Tenente?" The girls went away looking at their silhouettes and laughing. They were nice-looking girls. One of them worked in the wine shop across from the hospital. "All right," I said. "Take your cap off." "No, with it on." "It will not be so beautiful," the old man said. "But," he brightened, "it will be more military." He snipped away at the black paper, then separated the two thicknesses and pasted the profiles on a card and handed them to me. "How much?" "That's all right," he waved his hand. "I just made them for you." "Please," I brought out some coppers. "For pleasure." "No, I did them for a pleasure. Give them to your girl." "Many thanks until we meet." "Until I see thee." I went on to the hospital. There were some letters, an official one, and some others. I was to have 3 weeks' convalescent leave and then return to the front. I read it over carefully. Well, that was that. The convalescent leave started October 4th, when my course was finished. 3 weeks was 21 days. That made October 25th. I told them I would not be in, and went to the restaurant a little way up the street from the hospital for supper, and read my letters and the Corriere della Sera at the table. There was a letter from my grandfather, containing family news, patriotic encouragement, a draft for $200, and a few clippings. A dull letter from the priest at our mess, a letter from a man I knew who was flying with the French and had gotten in with a wild gang and was telling about it, and a note from Rinaldi asking me how long I was going to skulk in Milano and what was all the news. He wanted me to bring him phonograph records and enclosed a list. I drank a small bottle of Chianti with the meal, had a coffee afterward with a glass of cognac, finished the paper, put my letters in my pocket, left the paper on the table with the tip, and went out. In my room at the hospital, I undressed, put on pajamas and a dressing gown, pulled down the curtains on the door that opened onto the balcony, and sitting up in bed, read Boston papers from a pile Mrs. Myers had left for her boys at the hospital. The Chicago White Sox were winning the American League pennant, and the New York Giants were leading the National League. Babe Ruth was a pitcher then, playing for Boston. The papers were dull, the news was local and stale, and the war news was all old. The American news was all training camps. I was glad I wasn't in a training camp. The baseball news was all I could read, and I did not have the slightest interest in it. A number of papers together made it impossible to read with interest. It was not very timely, but I read at it for a while. I wondered if America really got into the war, if they would close down the major leagues. They probably wouldn't. There was still racing in Milan, and the war could not be much worse. They had stopped racing in France. That was where our horse Japalak came from. Catherine was not due on duty until 9 o'clock. I heard her passing along the floor when she first came on duty, and once saw her pass in the hall. She went to several other rooms and finally came into mine.
"I'm late, darling," she said. "There was a lot to do. How are you?" I told her about my papers and the leave.
"That's lovely," she said. "Where do you want to go?"
"Nowhere. I want to stay here."
"That's silly. You pick a place to go, and I'll come too."
"How will you work it?"
"I don't know, but I will."
"You're pretty wonderful."
"No, I'm not. But life isn't hard to manage when you've nothing to lose."
"How do you mean?"
"Nothing. I was only thinking how small obstacles seemed that once were so big."
"I should think it might be hard to manage."
"No, it won't, darling. If necessary, I'll simply leave it. But it won't come to that."
"Where should we go?"
"I don't care. Anywhere you want. Anywhere we don't know people."
"Don't you care where we go?"
"No, I'll like any place."
She seemed upset and taut. "What's the matter, Catherine?"
"Nothing. Nothing's the matter."
"Yes, there is."
"No, nothing. Really nothing."
"I know there is. Tell me, darling. You can tell me."
"It's nothing."
"Tell me."
"I don't want to. I'm afraid I'll make you unhappy or worry you."
"No, it won't."
"You're sure?"
"It doesn't worry me, but I'm afraid to worry you."
"It won't if it doesn't worry you."
"I don't want to tell."
"Tell it."
"Do I have to?"
"Yes."
"I'm going to have a baby, darling. It's almost 3 months along." "You're not worried, are you? Please, please don't. You mustn't worry."
"All right."
"Is it all right?"
"Of course."
"I did everything. I took everything, but it didn't make any difference."
"I'm not worried."
"I couldn't help it, darling, and I haven't worried about it. You mustn't worry or feel badly."
"I only worry about you."
"That's it. That's what you mustn't do. People have babies all the time. Everybody has babies. It's a natural thing."
"You're pretty wonderful."
"No, I'm not. But you mustn't mind, darling. I'll try and not make trouble for you."
"I know I've made trouble now, but haven't I been a good girl until now? You never knew it, did you?"
"No." "It will all be like that. You simply mustn't worry." "I can see you're worrying. Stop it. Stop it right away. Wouldn't you like a drink, darling? I know a drink always makes you feel cheerful."
"No, I feel cheerful, and you're pretty wonderful."
"No, I'm not. But I'll fix everything to be together if you pick out a place for us to go. It ought to be lovely in October. We'll have a lovely time, darling, and I'll write you every day while you're at the front."
"Where will you be?"
"I don't know yet, but somewhere splendid. I'll look after all that."
We were quiet a while and did not talk. Catherine was sitting on the bed and I was looking at her, but we did not touch each other. We were apart as when someone comes into a room and people are self-conscious. She put out her hand and took mine.
"You aren't angry, are you, darling?"
"No."
"And you don't feel trapped?"
"Maybe a little, but not by you."
"I didn't mean by me. You mustn't be stupid. I meant trapped at all."
"You always feel trapped, biologically." She went away a long way without stirring or removing her hand.
"Always isn't a pretty word."
"I'm sorry."
"It's all right. But you see, I've never had a baby, and I've never even loved anyone. And I've tried to be the way you wanted, and then you talk about always."
"I could cut off my tongue," I offered.
"Oh, darling."
She came back from wherever she had been.
"You mustn't mind me."
We were both together again, and the self-consciousness was gone.
"We really are the same one, and we mustn't misunderstand on purpose."
"We won't."
"But people do. They love each other, and they misunderstand on purpose, and they fight, and then suddenly they aren't the same one."
"We won't fight."
"We mustn't, because there's only us two, and in the world there's all the rest of them. If anything comes between us, we're gone, and then they have us."
"They won't get us," I said, "because you're too brave. Nothing ever happens to the brave."
"They die, of course."
"But only once."
"I don't know. Who said that?"
"The coward dies 1,000 deaths, the brave but one."
"Of course. Who said it?"
"I don't know."
"He was probably a coward," she said.
"He knew a great deal about cowards, but nothing about the brave. The brave dies perhaps 2,000 deaths if he's intelligent. He simply doesn't mention them."
"I don't know. It's hard to see inside the head of the brave." Yes, that's how they keep that way.
You're an authority.
You're right, darling, that was deserved.
You're brave.
No, she said, but I would like to be.
I'm not, I said. I know where I stand. I've been out long enough to know. I'm like a ball player that bats 230 and knows he's no better.
What is a ball player that bats 230? It's awfully impressive.
It's not. It means a mediocre hitter in baseball.
But still a hitter, she prodded me.
I guess we're both conceited, I said, but you are brave.
No, but I hope to be.
We're both brave, I said, and I'm very brave when I've had a drink.
We're splendid people, Catherine said. She went over to the armoire and brought me the cognac and a glass. Have a drink, darling, she said. You've been awfully good.
I really don't want one.
Take one.
All right. I poured the water glass a third full of cognac and drank it off.
That was very big, she said. I know brandy is for heroes, but you shouldn't exaggerate.
Where will we live after the war?
In an old people's home, probably, she said. For 3 years I looked forward very childishly to the war ending at Christmas. But now I look forward till when our son will be a lieutenant commander.
Maybe he'll be a general.
If it's an 100 years' war, he'll have time to try both of the services.
Do you want a drink?
No, it always makes you happy, darling, and it only makes me dizzy.
Did you ever drink brandy?
No, darling, I'm a very old-fashioned wife.
I reached down to the floor for the bottle and poured another drink.
I'd better go have a look at your compatriots, Catherine said. Perhaps you'll read the papers until I come back.
Do you have to go?
Now or later?
All right, now.
I'll come back later.
I'll have finished the papers, I said.